Although this week, it's been more about arguing with the boomers about the shit music that they've been claiming. Should we talk about that Songs of Brisbane thing?
Oh yes, so yes. That got the
balls after dark, folks. This is where we talk about music and we shout at boomers. So if you missed this, Brisbane Times, which is Fairfax's Queensland imprint, commissioned this piece talking about what are the songs of Brisbane. And they basically just interviewed a whole bunch of old white men who run record stores or have been music critics. And they produced a whole bunch of old white men bands like The Saints and The Go-Betweens. And I know they're not all white men, but bands of that kind of 80s, early 90s era. And it was all about that, and there was nothing, there was very little, let's say, post 1994.
I'm not expecting.
I think there was a tiny bit of Violent Soho, and somebody mentioned Vulture Street by Powderfinger in passing. Having said, I mean, Vulture Street's mostly an album of generic rock lyrics, so it's not really, I was at Festival Hall and then I went to the Treasury Casino. You know, it's not really about Brisbane.
Well, that's why I posted Refizzler by Lazy Grey, because like if you're dropping suburbs like Alcester, then you know it's fairly ground in the locality.
Yeah, I was thinking that you're much maligned Brisbane hip hop mates. Thanks very much, SBS Viceland. Would surely have a retort to the time and place stuff, because it's fair to say that generation of 90s Brisbane bands that we grew up with, your Regurgitators, Custards, Not From There, you know, pull them off the shelf, name them. They didn't really sing about Brisbane as much. And my theory is because Brisbane wasn't as fucked as it was in the 80s. If you look at all of the songs that those old white dudes were talking about from the 80s, it was songs about police brutality, living under a right-wing dictatorship, and living in a fucking backwater that it was lost to modern civilization. Mm. And that wasn't the Brisbane of the 90s. The Brisbane of the 90s and the Brisbane of the noughts was a fucking modern new world city looking forward to the future. And it's hard to, you don't tend to write about, hey, Brisbane's pretty good. We've got a bus service and trains and the bouncers aren't as much of cunts as they used to be. You know, what are you going to talk about?
It's funny how Expo 88 is really like the
together
line
we'll show the world.
Well, it's the line that slices Brisbane into being a more modern city. And like, okay, Brisbane's...
No, I would say that's fair. But remember, during World Expo 88, who stepped down?
Mm.
He got his ass run out the paint?
Yep.
It's the Joe line. It's the Wayne Goss line. The Joe Wayne Goss line. I know there was a brief somebody else who was in Joe's place there. But 89, when Wayne Goss got in power...
I think it was
That's when Queensland started, basically. It might have been Mike O'Hearn, yeah.
It'll be a little bit like when the Knicks finally get sold to a competent owner. And
yeah, there'll be a year zero.
It'll be the Dolan line.
Yeah, the Dolan line.
Sorry, I couldn't help
it. And then Dolan will be up on charges and for some reason Dolan's kids will be on the jury and it'll all get very confusing. But yeah, because there's less to get pissed off about Brisbane. I think Brisbane lives on in the aesthetic of the bands that it produces now. Your fucking, you know, your Violent Sohos, your Dune Rats, your DZ Death Rays, bands like that who have that kind of sloppy DIY Brisbane aesthetic, but they don't sing about Brisbane. I mean, what would even be a fucking Brisbane song be about in 2017?
But that's why
fucking
I think
Goths in the Queen Street Mall opposite. I mean, I think Hungry Jack's in the Queen Street Mall shut, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not
so
even open.
So what are you going to write songs about? There's your icon. It's gone. Done.
It was a lazy fucking piece of journalism, and it was a shit reflection on the music scene in Brisbane for the last 20 years, let alone now.
I didn't get as angry about it as you. I thought, you know, it was over Tom and Place. And the problem is that they haven't – all the songs they named were about Brisbane. They were literally about Brisbane. Mm. They spoke about Brisbane experiences in a very literal way. And that sort of song doesn't get written anymore. I mean, even Powderfinger, Brisbane's finest fucking sons of the 90s, have never written a song about Brisbane.
And that was
their most time and place song? What was it about? fucking Hindley Street in Adelaide, not Brisbane.
Yeah, because I actually went through and sort of like flicked through Powderfinger and the Gurge and
Gurge. You've like, never written a song like that.
Like even Resin Dogs, like Refizzlers, yeah. But the Refizzlers more a Brother Stoney song than a Resin Dogs song. You know, there's not that many great modern songs about Brisbane because Brisbane is just it's okay. It's a nice yeah, place.
It used to be fucking awful, and now it's okay.
It's okay. It's a nice place to live. It's fine. It's not the fucking. It's not a destination. It's a nice place to live. It's not a destination. What the fuck? It's not that interesting to write about.
Look, what would you write about if you were going to write a song about Brisbane? Stefan Space Needle?
I don't know. South Bank? I really like South Bank, but it's not exactly inspiring fucking songs, is it?
The old roller coaster in the Maya Centre. How about that? Throw it up and see if we can hit the bottom. That fucking fucked Eiffel Tower in Park Road.
Yeah, well, that's...
The thing is, it's just got a lot less differentiating factors since the end of the Pumpkin Junta. Yeah. It just doesn't... It doesn't have... You know, being a modern world-class city means you've got a lot less shit to talk about.
Well, look, the most evocative Queensland song that I know is Hey Rain. Oh, I can't remember who actually wrote it, but I've got a version of the basics that I play for the kids all the time. I've got a little sleep playlist. And you just listen to that song. And it absolutely brings North Queensland wet season into your head. If you've ever experienced a North Queensland wet season, as soon as this song starts, you know, the first verse, you're just like, oh, yeah, this is fucking, you know, Atherton in the wet season. It's just amazing how it brings that place into your head. And I don't even think any of the songs that they named really bring Brisbane into my head the same way that
I think an old Brisbane, sort of a Pig City era Brisbane. And I think Staffo has probably made some comments about this. Mm. But where are the songs about our Brisbane, the Brisbane we grew up with, like Scary Street, Dollar Drinks at City Rowers? Where's that Brisbane?
Yeah.
Standing in the front of the City Cat and getting that nasty fucking backwash of brown river water on your face. And none of this is good lyrical content.
You know, that's why I like Refizzler, because it is the Brisbane of my time, you know.
Yeah, which, like, nasty fucking sunbaked suburbia and
yes, smoking cones on the back deck and fucking watching football. Like,
well, actually, there was an interesting point there, because they pulled up Ed Cooper's, of the Saints, Electrical Storm, and they posed the question, what happened to the great electrical storms of Brisbane? Because when I first moved to Brisbane, you could guarantee a fucking big old nasty thunderstorm to entertain you, often while your power was knocked out, of an afternoon. Yeah. And they disappeared over the time I lived there, and they haven't been back.
No, that rolling, you know, like even in Gladstone when I was growing up, you know, at 4:30 in January, you know, there would be a storm come in, and you'd get a bit of, you know, a half-hour storm, and then it'd be nice and cool. yeah, that shit don't happen anymore.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, neither of us grew up in Brisbane, but I would say that we're not from Brisbane, but we're kind of Brisbane in that we've had a lot of formative experiences in Brisbane. I mean, so we're probably in a place where we can talk about this sort of stuff. It's not the same Brisbane of Ed Cooper and old mate from the go-between and so on and so forth, but it's a Brisbane that's not represented in that Songs of Brisbane thing, and maybe it's not represented in the Songs of Brisbane.
Yeah,
because the bands that we were around just weren't singing about it.
Originally, I thought they were talking about there's a great little open Spotify playlist of you know classic Brisbane songs, and it's not classic songs about Brisbane. It's classic bands bands of Brisbane, and it's got everything from what's the Savage Garden right through to, you know, I've got some Brother Stoney in there. So it's a really weird, eclectic mix, but it is of Brisbane, and it's sort of like a great little musical snapshot of what Brisbane's like. So I was hoping that they were, you know, that they were going to have an article about, you know, collaboration and Spotify and how Brisbane music is, you know, a lot of different things, and it's quite diverse and stuff like that. And instead, it was the same old fucking go-between and Saints stuff. So,
I mean, and that's not to say the go-betweens and the Saints are shit, but it's kind of... on from the go-betweens and the Saints?
They're a little bit overrepresented.
I like the Saints, but we're...
overrepresented in... Like, fuck, man, that...
Yeah, but they asked a bunch of 50-year-old men.
Yeah, well...
Like they asked the dude who runs Rocking Horse Records. Now, he's always going to name the stuff that was around when he started his fucking company, because... Like all nostalgia, the most important stuff is the stuff that happened at the fucking start when formative experiences.
Mate, some of the most influential...
Which is why we keep doing albums from 1994.
Some of the most influential Brisbane hip-hop personalities have worked for him at Rocking Horse. Like, you know, Len from Brother Stoney worked there for a decade.
Clearly didn't
rate
it, did he?
Ham's worked there. Ham's like one of the great Brisbane graphic artists. He worked there for... almost two decades.
That's kind of the point, isn't it? Is that there was no hip-hop represented in there, and hip-hop is the music form that talks most about experience.
Particularly
modern hip-hop. Yeah, I mean, that's clearly a thing. You talk about experience with hip-hop, and that's exactly why, A, those songs that you were talking about, like Reef Fizzler, talk about that experience, and B, the exemption of them from these lists is why they're missing everything from like 1989 to modern day, because it's just not represented.
Yeah. Well, even like some of the Shinky Row songs, which, you know, talk about, you know, catching trains to outer suburbs and playing backyard cricket in the, you know, like they're so, like that is what Brisbane was like when I lived in the outer suburbs and had to catch trains to uni when I first came to Brisbane in the late 90s or mid to late 90s. Like, That's why I think I love some of those Shinky Row songs so much, is because they just completely describe what it was
your
like
experience.
Going from a big country town where it wasn't even big enough to fucking have a train to, you know, having to get around on public transport around this, like, I know it's not a big city in terms of population, but it is a big city in terms of its geographical area.
It's big enough. It's got... I mean, are you up to 2 million yet? I mean, it's...
I don't know what the population
it's
is.
Scaring 2 million. I mean, the thing is that it's a continuum with the Gold Coast now, so it's and the sunny coast, so it's...
Oh, and that's the other thing. Like, the mind space-wise, even when I got here, like, it wasn't just Brisbane City. It was Brisbane sort of, stretched from the Sunshine Coast all the way to the Gold Coast, because...
Yeah, it was basically Nambour to the border.
Yeah. Yeah, anyway, I got a bit angry. But I get angry at old boomers like that. It's one of the things.
Well, the thing is that I respect that that's what was important, and those were important songs, and that was important in that Pig City era. And you know, the thing that I thought was interesting was that Staffo, who wrote Pig City, the counter-risen music, didn't seem entirely comfortable with the time boundedness of the list, the fact that it was so heavily embedded in that, kind of early 80s era, late 70s, early 80s.
This is what shits me a little bit about this style of journalism is, wouldn't you have a look at that list and go, geez, we're a bit fucking light on for the 90s and aughts. Maybe we should go and find someone who ran... Like, go and ask Jock and C from the Zoo. Like, dig them up and get their opinions, because they saw fucking all the music.
Actually, that would be really interesting. I think the problem we would keep coming back to is that the songs of the 70s and 80s were much more literally about Brisbane, in the same way that, you know, Cold Chisel literally sang songs about flame trees.
Mm. Whereas, but if anyone anyone knew what those songs were, what the songs of the 90s and the aughts were, it'd be, you know, Jock and C or someone of that ilk.
Yeah, you know, but they're never going to roll out some obscure... The problem is that if they had a list full of obscure hip-hop bands that only you and the people who'd recorded them knew about, no one's going to read that article.
Yeah, the go-betweens have a fucking bridge named after them.
Exactly right. And the other thing is that what was the purpose of that article?
Clicks. I would imagine.
What have we just done to that article?
I know, we've been talking about it for 16 minutes.
Have we not? So, and then I'm sure the journalist in question is had the purest of intentions and wasn't writing clickbait, because Fairfax don't do that. But also doesn't know anything about Brisbane music.
No.
Because she's 15. And as a result, I mean, what's a saint? What's a regurgitator? What's any of this shit? It's just a whole bunch of old man bands that I'm going to talk about. She just wants to go and watch Ed Sheeran or some shit. Ed Sheeran's about to break the record for the biggest Australasian tour. The record was held by AC/DC. They're putting on three shows in Dunedin in the packing out the fucking the big plastic lunchbox.
I've never really listened to any of his music. Is
it? No, I haven't either. I think he's just generic fucking. It's not for me. So in the last couple of years, I've become much more aware of not bagging the shit out of stuff that isn't for me. Like Katy Perry, it's not for me. Ariana Grande, there are all these fucking edgelords queuing up to say, oh, well, people got killed at an Ariana Grande conference. I feel like killing myself when I listen to Ariana Grande. Like, fuck off. It's just inoffensive pop music. How the fuck does it hurt you? What the fuck is wrong with you?
The beautiful thing about now is music is super, super accessible. I was listening to a podcast today that was talking about soundtracks in the 90s and how there was like a golden era of soundtracks where there was effort put into the soundtracks and getting bands to be on a soundtrack and carefully crafted, and you know, they were big songs. And for some people that weren't big into music, that soundtrack might be the only album that they bought for a month or two months or three months.
It was a curation of music.
Yeah, that's right. So that it had to be good. Whereas now it's so much easier to listen to music, and like there's no barrier for someone to listen to. Like even if you don't have a Spotify subscription, you just go to YouTube. You can listen to a whole heap of music for free quite easily. You know, you can listen to the free tier of Spotify quite easily. So why get upset about people liking music that you don't like? Just fucking let them, you know? Try and listen to some of their music and try and suggest some of your music to them, and maybe one or the other will expand their mind a little bit. Like, what's the other guy that's like Ed Sheeran, extremely popular and who's quite funny on Twitter? I keep thinking of Ed Sheeran.
James Blunt. Well, he's like old enough to be Ed Sheeran's dad, I think.
Yeah, so like he's got a
He was driving tanks in Kosovo in the 90s. That's his shtick, was that he was a UN peacekeeper in the 90s in the Balkans. So he's probably older than us.
Like, he's got a new album out this year, and it's supposed to be a little bit different from his normal stuff. And I'm tempted to maybe not pick it, but at least have a listen. Because why not? Like, I'm not fucking paying for it. Yeah. I might as well have a listen and see whether the opinions of some people that it is actually different from his normal sort of, you know, popish stuff are right. Like,
that's supposed to be true with the new Harry Styles, is that it sounds, someone said, this sounds like Cooler Shaker, which I suspect is not true. But, I mean, Cooler Shaker did tremendous kind of 60s-influenced Britpop in the... they did one album of it and they disappeared because they sucked thereafter. But it was... I can imagine somebody doing a kind of a synthetic version of that. Well, and like doing it pretty well.
Like this Dappled Cities album, right, that we've got this week.
Oh, that's so organic, man. That is so organic that Monsanto are basically shaking their fist at you.
I don't think it's bad music, but I got to the end of the album the second time and went, this is just not music for me.
Like, no, so it's kind of, I mean, Dappled Cities, formerly Dappled Cities Fly, and they dropped The Fly a couple of years ago. It's kind of downbeat, kind of a, there was a bit of acoustic folk infused pop, and there was a bit of 80s prog. And a few kind of spaced out, kind of verging on sort of recent Tame Impala, which is bad Tame Impala, jams. It's fine.
Very ethereal and sort of floaty and like, look, I
pretty melodies. It's fine.
Pretty, you know, it's, pr- pretty is the word that I would use to describe it. Pretty is a great it's word pleasant. To describe it. It's very pretty music.
It's inoffensive.
Not for me.
It's unchallenging.
No.
It's like the perfect old music. It's like if you were forced to listen to this, you'd be like, oh, this is rather lovely. If you've listened to it twice and you're looking for deeper meaning or interest, you're like, that was boring as fuck, man. I got nothing. Yeah. And that's really where I've got 2.5 lines. I have like 2 pages of notes on Soundgarden. I have 2.5 lines on Dappled Cities.
Whereas Kasabian, right, is still very poppy, but it's fun. Like, I had fun listening to it.
Do you feel like Kasabian are a Britpop band that really, when they grow up, they want to be like Ibiza DJ fucking club bangers dudes? Absolutely.
And this album just lacks, it lacks a real catchy banger. Like you can see.
Dappled City, it has no, there are no bangers. Bangers aren't the remit. That's not what they do.
No, Kasabian is what I was talking about.
Oh, Kasabian. Well, here's the thing about Kasabian. If you'll indulge me, I have a little, I have some prepared material. Because you'll know that the only Kasabian album, it's a double album. I listened to the second album first because I thought, oh, look, it's a live album. It'll kind of be a recap. It'll catch me up. It's like the previously on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It'll be that for Kasabian's career because, you know, I know Kasabian. I know Fire, obviously, which is, as far as I'm concerned, that's their biggest single because it was the one the Premier League used for their match day music for a couple of years. But the live gig on the second CD is live at the King Power. The King Power is the home stadium of Leicester City Football Club. Kasabian are from Leicester City.
Yeah, right.
The very first voice you hear on the Kasabian live at King Power is Claudio Ranieri talking about how he used to play Kasabian to the team to fire them up. This is the concert they played the night after the game where they were given the Premier League trophy. This is the greatest night in Leicester's life. This is the greatest night in Kasabian's life. And they say it over and over again, that this is the greatest night in their fucking life. So this is the greatest live gig they will ever play. And it's pretty good as a live gig. I mean, as a band, they've got a much more direct... They've got a through line to that early 90s Britpop sound, particularly probably more that kind of Happy Mondays, fucking Stone Roses early 90s Britpop than the kind of Oasis
Oasis pulp one,
But also they've got bits of that Super Furry Animals, Cooler Shaker, those kind of weirder Britpop bands. But they love a stadium banger. And it's such a joyous fucking live album. But if that album is kind of Leicester's 15-16 season, I feel like the new album is their 16-17 season.
You're working towards that.
Yeah, it's just not quite right. It's kind of, I mean, it's not bad. They're not getting relegated, but it's kind of mid-table. There's a couple of good tracks. There's the 4-2 against Man City, that's in there, but there's also the 6-1 loss to Spurs, that's also in this album. It's kind of. Yeah, there's kind of mid-table obscurity is what I'd call this album.
Well, I got to the end of it and I was like, where's the song that I want to go back and listen to?
Where's the banger? Where's the fucking Ibiza banger?
And like we've said before that you shouldn't judge an album on this because, you know, we're all about the album rather than the single. But this sort of music is exactly... the sort of music that should have a banger.
Yeah.
It should have a headline
song. Because it's incoherent. It doesn't, there's no flow from track to track. It's kind of loud song, quiet song. This is the very obvious acoustic ballad. This is the disco-infused shit that even Ricky Martin would turn his nose up at. This is, it's built by segments, and it's not as though this was conceived or created as an album. It's a collection of songs.
Mm. I still enjoyed it, though. Won't go on my 2017 shortlist, but I still enjoyed the fuck out of it.
Yeah, it was good fun. Did you know your boy Dan the Automator used to work with it?
Yeah, that does not surprise me at all.
Yeah, not on this album.
Yeah. No, and he's the sort of guy that has that touch, doesn't he? That just tweaks bands in the right direction, you know, into something a little bit more than what they are without that, that good direction. So, anyway.
Yeah, if you're going to listen to this album, just listen to the live album, because it's much more...
I listened so to the main to album three times. I don't think I got more than a couple of tracks into the live album because I kept trying to focus and go back to the main one.
Yeah, well, it's mainly for the joy, because it's very clear that this is a band who are all Leicester City fans who have been asked to play at the greatest moment of their favourite club's history in a ridiculous... I mean, the first track on the live album is called Underdog, and it's a song about underdogs, like, well, this one's for the underdogs. And the crowd is basically the Leicester City crowd, and it's just such a glorious, joyous, affirmatory experience that you think, I don't even like this band necessarily, but this is fucking awesome. I really enjoyed it. You really just commit yourself to it.
Like a premiership parade with a band.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. It's like they might as well be playing from an open-top bus. Which is why the subsequent album was always going to be a letdown, much like Leicester's 16-17 season, and I presume they sacked their tour manager.
Mm.
Replaced him with Craig Shakespeare.
Shall we talk about...
Shall we do some Soundgardening Australia? There's Peter Cundall and his manure. Now, we should say that the inspiration isn't the right word, but the trigger for doing this was Craig Cornell's a different dude entirely. You don't want to hear his bandits shit. Chris Cornell's passing, Chris Cornell's suicide, as we discovered subsequently, and that does impact how you go listening to the albums. And I wouldn't normally do this, but I am going to do this, and it's not because I want to annoy our audience of white boomers, but I'd like to put a little trigger warning on the podcast because we're going to be talking about suicide. And the reason we're going to be talking about suicide is that Chris Cornell talked about suicide a lot in his lyrics. And that's something that's probably going to pop up.
It's interesting that he had... Like, you would have said that he was... a Kurt Cobain candidate, that he was more likely to do this five years after Super Unknown than now.
This is interesting because this is something that our friends of the pod, the drive-through pod people at the drive-through, they did a podcast about a day or two after he passed. And of course, they're big in music, particularly Dave. And it's worth looking into that if you're interested in it, but it does get quite visceral because it's quite raw because it's quite recent to when it actually happened. But that point actually came up. Dave was making the comment that you almost felt like he'd managed to get past that stage of his life. You felt like he was almost safe. You get past that Club 27 that took that took Kurt Cobain and Jimi Hendrix and all those other great talents that got taken out in the 27 Club. But it's a reminder that kind of mental illness is a fucking forever war. It is a permanent battle to keep the fucking wolves from the door. And you kind of, you forget, I mean, as I say, we've trigger warning this, and I know that some people get upset about trigger warnings, ironically. They get triggered by trigger warnings. Quite why you'd get upset by somebody, you know, putting out a bit of a content warning for somebody who's going through trauma that they might need to put on their fucking armor and you know, take a moment to deal with some stuff. I don't see how that affects anybody, but apparently it upsets old white dudes. Sorry, I actually am quite pissed off about that sort of thing, but that's a separate issue entirely. You... lost my thread.
Look...
I might just keep ranting about trigger warnings.
No, I think the thing that... Yeah, this is the trap that a lot of people fall into with mental illness, having dealt with it myself, but dealt with someone who quite close to me who's got
who's had it.
Yeah, no, I've seen it. I've seen it in a couple of people. It is that people think that when you come up in this, you know, when you come out of that, the really bad part of it, that you're cured, that you're fixed forever. And it's just, your brain doesn't fucking work like that. Nah. It's peaks and troughs and peaks and troughs. And you've constantly got to be aware of when someone might be heading into that trough. If you're close to someone, you've got to be aware and know that that's happening, and you should be more well prepared to help them then. But the amount of people I know that just go to someone that's had some sort of mental illness, well, you're better now. That's it. You know, for the next 50 years of your life, you're never going to have that happen again. It's like, but if you said to someone, well, when you have a cold and you stop having that cold and you feel better, you're going to say to someone, oh, you've had your cold now. You're never, ever going to have a cold in your life again.
Yeah. It's not chicken pox.
People would say you're fucking ridiculous, you know. And that's why thinking about it after a week and listening to the album, I was not that surprised that he was someone that would happen to. I find it incredibly sad that he didn't have the support mechanisms around him at that particular time, so that he didn't
That's actually the tragedy of it. He had his wife there. He was on any anxiety meds. But the thing is, and it sounds like, and I'm hearing this, you know, I haven't looked at this myself because I haven't been game to, you know, to be perfectly honest, but on Drive Through Pod, they talked about a little bit that that he'd probably misdosed on his anti-anxiety medication. And the problem with those anti-anxiety meds, I've got a little bit of experience of this sort of stuff. The brain chemistry is fucking complicated. It's like one of those big old Rube Goldberg machines, like you see in an OK Go video, where you do one thing and it fucking all this other shit happens. It's all, a lot of these anti-anxiety and depressive and fucking SSRI type drugs. It's like taking a fucking 20 kilo bag of cement and just dumping on part of it, saying, right, that bit's fixed. The effects on the rest of it are, you know, shit's going to go on all over the place. And that's kind of the it's a like a blunt instrument slash double-edged sword, the drugs that are available. And if you don't get it exactly right, the consequences can be fairly awful. I don't want to go into detail of, as I say, again, our man Staffo was good enough to point out that you've got to be very careful about how media presents suicides and not talking too much about the method, because there is a complicated effect, not in a, I want to be cool like this dude sort of thing, but in a, I'm in a really bleak space and apparently that works, so I'll try that sort of thing. So I'll be conscious. But I was made aware of how Chris did himself in during the week. And, of course, that impacted my listening to the albums, because let's be honest, to be totally frank, track one, Down on the Upside, look it up. That's basically what we did. And that has made it a fucking difficult, that has coloured my enjoyment of these albums, and it will for the rest of time, I expect.
So I deliberately didn't push too hard into the lyrics.
I can totally understand that.
I know you're much more a lyrics guy than I am anyway, but I was not massive into Soundgarden in period. Like, they were above Nirvana in my mind space, but definitely below Pearl Jam and Faith No More and Stone Temple Pilots. Like, you know, I liked the singles, but I wasn't
That last one's an interesting admission, because there would be very few people of our gen who would say, no, Stone Temple Pilots were more significant to me than Soundgarden, just because in those days, cool was more important than anything else. And there's no way Stone Temple Pilots were as cool as Soundgarden in that particular era.
Well, I would have to say Alice in Chains were above Soundgarden.
Good point. Alice in Chains were probably, because the darker and bleaker it was, the more kind of cred you got.
I especially missed this album. And I'm a little bit disappointed I missed this album in period, because it's a fucking kicker of an album.
It's a really good album.
It's really varied. It's got Like his voice is just a weapon. Like,
I'll just say that I didn't listen to this version of the album because the version of the album I had as a CD was like a tour version that had She Likes Surprises as a bonus track. So I listened to that version. And on that version, there was a second CD with instrumentals. And they had some instrumental versions of the tracks on the album. And listening to those, it really reinforced how important a fucking instrument Cornell's voice is. It is most important instrument on the entire album, without any question.
I would actually... I don't think the Audio Slave album is as good, but I would almost say that his voice as an instrument mixes better with the Audio Slave band than with Soundgarden's.
That might be just the dynamic range it sits in. One of the things I noticed when I listened to the other Soundgarden albums is that the production on this is a step change from everything they'd done before. Before they were much more trebly and up in the top, whereas this album, it might also be a songwriting choice because this album has a lot more slower kind of doom laden, almost Black Sabbath style crunching fucking riffs.
Big crunching down the low riffs.
Yeah, whereas previously they'd been much more, I mean, in places they'd been kind of twiddly speed metal. And if you listen to Rusty Cage off their previous album, Bad Motorfinger, that's kind of much more of what they were doing. Whereas this album is very, it's sort of doom metal more than grunge.
I have to say too, I don't know where they sort of fit into because they're not. Are Faith No More grunge? Do you reckon? Like what are Faith No More?
Well,
Patton is really like the bastard child of that era. Like
they predate this stuff. They were a metal band. They were an alternative metal band. And you know what? Soundgarden saw themselves as a metal band. They didn't see themselves as a grunge band, whatever the fuck grunge was. They were just, they happened to be around at the same time as Nirvana and the smooth FM of grunge music, Pearl Jam.
But they were in that place. I think that's the thing, that a little bit like trip hop, Seattle grounds that. Seattle is what turns it into grunge.
A genre. That's why the presidents of the United States of America were grunge. I still just love the mental picture of the fact that the presidents of the United States of America were around at the same time as these bands on the same scene, and they were all mates to the point where Kim Thayil, the big ass fucking hairy ass guitarist from Soundgarden, did some guitar parts on that President's of the United States album. The kind of the guitar noodles on Naked and Famous. That was Kim Thayil from Soundgarden.
The presidents were that mate that you had at a party who just was constantly doing fucking jokes and lighting farts and doing stupid shit. Don't you reckon? Everyone else was serious.
That was me, mate. That was
trying to impress girls, and the presidents are off in the corner doing stupid shit.
Yeah, that was me. I am the president of this fucking analogy.
But I just think Patton's, I don't know, he never had the level of fame that any of these guys had. You know, the Nirvanas, the Pearl Jams, the Soundgardens.
They were a different sort of band. I mean, they popped out, when they started out, they were doing fucking rock, funk, metal fusion like they were the fucking Chili Peppers. That was really where they were. I mean, We Care A Lot could be a Chili Peppers song, a freaky styling.
Yeah, and they were Californian.
Why they would fit into that space.
Yep.
So Soundgardening Australia, this Super Unknown is a, I mean, setting aside all the bleak talk, I mean, this is something that came up in discussion, and probably a good example of this is last Saturday, I was on Twitter, and our man, Albion Lovedown, I'm sure he won't mind us sharing this anecdote, with every so while would post a Soundgarden lyric, and they were all bleak as fuck. It was like, I know I'm heading for the bottom, but I'm riding you all the way, and stuff like that. And I was like, okay, I hope he's okay. And after about an hour or so of this, I actually hit him up and said, you're right, man? I mean, I know these are lyrics, but they're all bleak. Are you okay? And he goes, yeah, I'm sad, but I'm cool. You know, thanks for your concern. And then when I listened back to the album, I remembered, Oh, I know why he was posting bleak lyrics. Because all the fucking lyrics are bleak. Every single fucking one of them is bleak as fuck. It is just a fucking textbook on misery and hate and self-loathing and revenge and frankly suicide. And it makes it really hard to chew through. And I'm sure in time it'll be a little bit like Nirvana's back catalogue, whereby the fact that the dude met his end doesn't become front of mind when you think about it.
Mm.
It'll stop being an issue. In fact, I was talking to again, Dave from Drive Thru Pod, and he put forward the theory that the song that least talks about suicide on the album is actually the song Like Suicide. And I think he's almost got a point there. But there are a lot of really ace tracks on this. One of the songs that's not about suicide is Kickstand, but I never understood. This is me reusing a joke on Twitter that didn't work. I never really understood why Kickstand got the Jews to fill his cup. And I never really worked out whether that was anti-Semitic. We'll gloss over that one.
I'll see where you're going with it.
Go back and listen to Kickstand, and you tell me he's not singing Kickstand, you got the Jews to fill my cup. It's like, why are the Jews filling your cup? That's weird.
The thing that surprised me about listening to this album as a whole was the the light and shade in it. Like, there's a lot more mood in it than I guess if you just think of it as Spoon Man and you know, Black Hole Sun.
Then you're missing about five singles there. I mean, you actually look at the number of songs that were released that were singles off this album.
I think it comes back to that thing that I love about albums is that it feels like it's got an ebb and flow to it. This is a good definition of a classic album. Like, it works better if you listen to the whole album than if you just listen to the well-known singles.
Yeah.
I got a lot more I listened to that the Chris Cornell playlist last week before we recorded last week's, and I really enjoyed that, and it was, you know, sort of reminding me how much I like the songs. But listening to this album gave me a deeper appreciation of this album. It's really well constructed. It flows well. There's not a wasted song on it.
It's 70 minutes long, and it never actually feels too long. It doesn't feel like you could go through and go, no, that song's wasted. No, you need that's over the top. The whole thing, there doesn't seem feel like there's a lot of fat on this album, even though it goes for more than an hour, which is
which you normally hate.
Exactly, right. It's fucking rare. Oh, it goes more than that if you include the version I had with the bonus track.
Mm. Great album on headphones too, I have to say.
Yeah.
Yep.
Great space.
It's contains a lot of space in that headphone. You know, when you listen to it and you can get all those little bits that are underneath, or you get that bass line, or you get the drum. Like, I have to say, doing this podcast, I've gained a much bigger appreciation for how important drumming is for a really good fucking album. You know, especially on headphones, it just gives it something else. When the drums are just like, you know, almost like something out of fucking Pro Tools, you know, it can really drag an album back down, no matter how good the lyric or the music being played is. But when you get really fucking good drums like Honey Blood, or, you know, a couple of the other ones that I've been keen on, Satan Takes a Holiday was another one like that I really liked the drumming in.
I think you like a nice, well-hit snare. I think that's the things that unify those. But that's a good point, because the production on this is, as I said before, a step change from the production on the albums previously. And it was a bit thin and reedy on a lot of the previous albums. Even Bad Motorfinger, which you can sense, I mean, their first two couple of albums is a much more metal and much more high register and trebly. And a bit twiddly and not really that satisfying, to be perfectly honest. There are some old heads who prefer that old sound, but I'm certainly not in their number. Bad Motorfinger sounds, the song structures are more like what ended up on Super Unknown. But even if you get the fucking remastered 25th anniversary version, it still doesn't sound as doesn't have the depth and the meatiness and the fucking resonance of the of Super Unknown. It's, you know, a bit rich to say it's the Bob Rockification of them, because it's got that massive kind of Metallica sound drum kit and huge meaty guitars, but that's kind of what we're getting at.
Interestingly, the producer on this album also produced Future Shock by Herbie Hancock, The Uplift Mofo Party Plan and Mother's Milk by the Chili Peppers, Why Do Birds Sing by Violent Femmes, Hot Diggity by Raw Youth.
I did look up what the dude's name was, and I can't remember what it is.
It's Michael
Dietrich.
Beanhorn.
Beanhorn. I knew it was something German.
Yeah. So, like, he's got a, you know, the, you know,
but the,
Mother's the Milk and...
But those albums are not bottom-end albums.
No.
I mean, this sounds like... This is an apocalyptic fucking... I mean, you know, I'm thinking of songs like Mailman and The Day I Tried to Live, which have these massive, ponderous fucking demolition ball crashing through buildings sort of riffs to them. Which again... Part of this is about songwriting differences, because they weren't writing songs like that on Louder Than Love and on Bad Motorfinger as much. They weren't writing these fucking huge Neolithic riff-based songs like that was like Sabbath. They were kind of very Black Sabbath-y kind of songs. They just weren't writing them, but they weren't producing them in this way either. So I went back and listened to the first couple of albums. I went and listened to Bad Motorfinger, which is probably, I would say, their third best album. It had some good songs, but that production thing is a bit of an issue. Down on the Upside, which is the 96 album, has some good songs on it. Maybe a touch lighter, a touch more melodic, although the lyrics are probably darker, if anything. It does get a bit kind of Faith No More prog rock. I can see why old heads were down on it, but they're probably good to very good. It's just not quite as good as Super Unknown. And I wasn't game enough to listen to their 2012 comeback album, because after that Faith No More comeback album I just don't have time to take risks like that anymore, folks.
Well, what are we batting? Two good old band.
I think we've done more than that, but it's...
Oh, no, like there are more two hits. Like,
there are more losses than wins. There are
Chemical Brothers and Prodigy are the only two, I think, that we've really been happy with.
There's been plenty acceptable, but there's been quite a lot that have... The biggest problematic ones are the ones that were just completely departed from their original plan. What I wanted to say was I would shout out a... given the bleak, if you'd like to listen to Soundgarden, but you can't deal with the bleak lyrics, because you're in a space where you can't, and I understand that, there is a rarities album on. I think we popped it in the I popped it in the show notes for last week. There's a rarities album that has a CD that's entirely covers, and there's something about having all of that Soundgarden's immense power being used on a Devo track. That is really kind of awesome. If it's singing like Girl You Want by Devo or some shit, or Smokestack Lightning by Howlin' Wolf, or, you know, Everyone's Got Something to Hide Except for Me and My Monkey by the Beatles. That, you get all of Cornell and all the power of the band, but you get a different sort of song structure. So that's a thing that's cool.
A bit of whimsy,
yeah. Oh, I did have a thing to say about, just to finish up the thing about trigger warnings. I mean, obviously, they're not meant for the people who complain about them, but if you're thinking about what they're meant for, people who have gone through trauma, and if you haven't gone through that, then it's not your problem. And it reminds me of a mate of mine who, I think this was after our year 12 formal, we went out to someone's farm and all got on the terps. I wasn't drinking at that stage, but various friends of mine were. And the smartest dude I knew was a dude called Darren. He's gone on to be massively rich by being an actuary for an insurance company, but he was smoking. He used to smoke in those days, and he was well off his chops. And he knew that I wasn't keen on his smoking, because I was, you know, sort of punishing dude who'd say, you know, you're going to kill yourself. What the fuck are you doing? And he said, Doc, well, obviously he didn't call me Doc because that nickname didn't exist, but he said, Doc, don't have to worry about it. Look, check this out. Here we go. And he showed me the pack of cigarettes he had. A pack of cigarettes he had said, your smoking can harm your unborn child. And he said, I purposely got these because it doesn't apply to me. I'm not going to have any children. Don't, if a trigger warning doesn't apply to you, you don't have to worry about it.
That's some great logic there. That's some fantastic logic.
Wasn't wrong.
So what have you got? What have you got for me that's new this week?
Before we get to that, should we run through a bit of the other stuff that's popped up? Should we shout some shouts to the late great Sir Roger Moore? It was the last link to James Bond movies that were any good. Well, maybe not any good, but any fun.
Well, we talked a little bit about this
on the internet.
And we sort of you think Bourne and Mission Impossible sort of, but I think they got wedged from both ends.
Yeah.
You know.
They definitely tried to be Bourne Mission Impossible style, shaky handy cam, gritty as fuck, no jokes. This is serious end of the world shit.
But I think Austin Powers also took that camping. Like you look at that Roger Moore sort of stuff, and it was so fun. It was so fucking, you know, wink.
It was
wink
the Batman
at the
TV series.
Yeah,
it was exactly that kind of knowing wink to the camera. This is all taken, and it was, and in that context, it was aimed at kids. And that's kind of the problem. When we talked briefly on Twitter, there was one attempt to make a movie in the style of the old Bond films in terms of the Kingsman. Mm. But the problem is that it was so adult in terms of it was graphic violence and sexual references and stuff. It was anal sex jokes are not going to fly with the parents of 8 to 12-year-old boys.
Mm. Well, I can't remember.
Well, they might fly with the parents when the kid isn't around.
Well, I think that was it, is that they realised that people that liked Bonds when they were 12 don't like Bonds now because they're, like, the funny thing is with Bonds is now they're actually like a rip-off of other more successful movie franchises, which is a sad thing to say because, like, but Bonds for me when I was sort of early to late teens were like appointment viewing, you know. When the Bond came out, you went and saw it the first day.
Oh, shit. Well, when we were kids, there were no Bonds. Mm. Because when we were teenagers, there was that long gap between Timothy Dalton in 89
and Brosnan
in like 95. So all you had was like every second fucking Saturday night, there'd be like an old Roger Moore or maybe a less commonly a Sean Connery Bond on Channel 10 being repeated. Like I've seen...
Yeah.
Live and Let Die, like 7 times, I think.
Yeah.
Moonraker and Spy Who Loved Me equally, the amount number of times.
Yeah, definitely, just on TV all the time. But I can remember going to Chermside, the cinemas at Chermside, and it must have been before I was at university because I was there on holidays. I went with my cousin. He took me to the Bond movie at Chermside. So,
well, GoldenEye was Boxing Day 95. So that was that would have been fuck. That was 95 was my year 12, so it was must have been. I think you're a year or two older than me, so yeah.
Mm.
But I mean, the thing is that I was a huge Bond fan. I read all the Bond books in high school. Did that instead of studying for the HSC. So I found all the old Ian Fleming James Bond books in secondhand stores across the course of year 11 and year 12, and I read them all. They're a very different sort of book. I mean, obviously, they're written in the 50s and 60s, so they're misogynist and racist as fuck, but but you kind of, you have to kind of put it through a filter of, okay, setting that aside, you know, this is kind of where it is. So I was a huge Bond fan, and I was fanging for the Bond, for GoldenEye to come out, and I think that actually impacts how much I like it, and also the fact that they made a tremendous fucking N64 game out of it. Which I was still playing well into the 2000s.
Well, I think too, like I posted today that trailer where they cut together.
That was fucking awesome. I would watch the shit out of that.
They cut Roger Moore into Spectre. And it's like, you could still actually make a proper Bond movie now.
You need Bond to take the piss. You needed to be a bit of a smartass, a smug fucking self-aggrandizing prick.
Like, now's the opportunity that you have, because you could go away from Daniel Craig and find someone like that, that, you know, has that British fucking smarminess. And,
if Daniel Craig just stopped playing it like somebody had been kept under the stairs and beaten with a fucking broom handle his entire life. Mm. I mean, that's the problem. He's gone for the Mad Max angle. I mean, he's gone for the I'm suffering from PTSD from all my experiences angle, which is a legitimate reading of the character based on the description of it. Mm. But Roger Moore never gave you the impression that he was still fucked up about his parents dying when he was 10 or whatever else had happened to Bond across the years. He did not give a fuck. He was a cartoon character, and that's kind of what people want.
And the biggest problem with that is that Damon's done it way better. That those first three Bourne movies just fucking, they just destroy.
Yeah, that if you're going to make that sort of movie, then that sort of movie's been made.
Yeah, he just does it so much better. So
why not just make
go back to being a Bond movie? You know, why do you have to fuck around with?
Get it? Fucking who are those cunts who play Thor and shit? Get one of them in.
Yeah.
Just get one of them in to ponce about and sort of look simpering and all the rest of it. Like, mate, didn't he have a role in Ghostbusters where he was basically that? Just a very pretty, very clueless idiot?
Yep.
Just do that. Yeah. Perfect.
Or even, you know, like, there's so many people that could do it in the, like, the amount of talented actors there are in Britain is ridiculous, you know.
I would love to see a remake of Live and Let Die, but with Idris Elba. So you get rid of all the massively racist shit that goes on in that movie. Suddenly it becomes more of a blaxploitation movie, but you can cheer for. It stops being quite as problematic.
Unfortunately, Idris has already found his movie franchise, and it's not that one. So,
what's he doing?
He's doing Stephen King's Dark Tower.
Oh, who cares about that? He can do James Bond.
Mm. Which will actually...
When was the last time anything from Stephen King mattered?
Well, that one will actually be pretty good. And not Woody Harrelson. Who's... Matthew McConaughey's playing the bad guy. And looks
Woody Harrelson, looks, Matthew McConaughey. I mean, what is the difference?
What is the difference? He looks fucking nuts. He just looks like he's having the most fun ever. So I like movies where actors just look like they're having the fucking time of their lives, which is why I like the Ocean's 11 movies, because it just looks like... They've been on the piss for about 4 days and then, should we shoot a movie? Fuck yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, but that's how all of Adam Sandler's last 9 movies were made, and they don't look any fucking good. Yeah, speaking of incoherent, incomprehensible shit, Twin Peaks.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I wanted to say. It was always shit, and it's not going to improve. And don't fucking at me with this. Oh, it's so much cleverer than you can understand. You don't understand what the fuck's going on. Lynch doesn't understand what the fuck's going on. Nobody understands what the fuck's going on because nothing is going on. It's fucking incoherent shit. Having said that, I used to have a poster of Cheryl and Fenn from Twin Peaks when I was at uni. It was an attempt to have a girly picture on my wall that would make girls interested in me rather than think I was a pervert. Because, of course...
How'd that go?
None. That did not go well. But she had lovely bosoms. We should talk about the music that we're going to talk about next week.
Sure.
We should talk about the talk about that. We're not going to listen to Kasabian again. It will surprise.
We're into May, and my shortlist for the year is only 3 albums long.
Starting to warm up. Well, that's all right. You've got classic album duty this week. I've got new albums duty this week. It's the 26th of May as we record this, and on the 26th of May, Friends Will Rom released their album, High Viz High Tea.
That was a feeling this one would be this week.
That was going to go in. Now, Friends Will Rom are one of my favourite bands. They're terrible. But they are terribly funny, and they are still I hear that conservatism is the new punk rock. I think the old punk rock still has a bit to say about that.
Well, it's a very classic 35 minutes, I have to say.
20 tracks, 35 minutes.
Yep.
Very Friends of Rob. The other and keeping in the format which I'm going to take my inspiration from you in terms of picking old washed up bands and hoping they'll make some sort of decent comeback. I'm getting Discovery Weekly and Release Radar feeding me a lot of At the Drive-In. And I never liked At the Drive-In in period. I thought they were shit house. And I saw one of their live sets. I think it was Big Day Out 2003 or 2004. And thought, you pack of fucking wankers. But I keep getting fed bits of their stuff that makes me think, oh, that's not bad. And I keep getting fed like side projects of At the Drive-In people that also makes me think, oh, that's not bad. So they have a new album out called, I think it's Inter Alia or something. But it's punctuated weirdly because it's at the fucking drive-in. I'm going to roll the dice on this one. I'm going to do a Bezo special, old bands. See if they can do something cool.
I think it's Inter Alia, which is how it's...
Like in dot, of, ter you, dot, r yeah. dot, yeah. It's punctuated yeah, in some...
As you would see it in a dictionary sort of...
Yeah, thing. It's very at the drive-through. Fucking wankers.
At the drive-in, mate.
Yeah, at the drive-thru wankers too. You're not listening to this podcast.
You can't let that IndyCar story go, can you?
I was thinking more our podcast friends from Wellington.
Classic.
I listened to At the Drive-In's album and I got robbed and I didn't even get a fucking quesadilla out of it.
So this classic album this week is not from the 90s. Oh, shock. Shock horror.
Thank God for that, because I thought when you sent me a photo earlier in the day, I thought, oh, no. Double album of jizz. That's what we need.
No, it's every time I send you a tweet about what night we're recording, I get tonight in my head. It just pops in my head.
Oh, thank God. I thought you were actually proposing Melancholy Infinite Sadness as a fucking classic album. I was going to have to drop some fun. I was going to, at least I'd have a week to work on my fucking sledges because there would be some truth dropped about that album.
No. I would pick that, but I know you don't like it. No, that's
because it's not good. There's one good album hiding in there, but it's not. A double album.
Yes, I've got another one in my classic list that's a little like that. No, I am going to go very close to home with a friend of the podcast because I thought I had picked this as a classic album, and I have talked about it before, but I have not picked it as a classic album, and that is Aussie Battler's 2010 album, Wild Colonial.
I'm thinking really hard because I know I've listened to it and I don't remember whether it wasn't in the context of a classic album.
I double checked.
No, we haven't done that. I don't understand. I don't remember when we did it. Maybe we must have done it off the grid, but yeah.
Well, I think we've talked about it in terms of other hip hop albums and sort of where it fits in Australian hip hop, but we haven't picked it as a classic album, and I have a very good idea of why I think it's a classic album. This is
because it's done by your mate.
Well, not only that, but it's close to my favourite hip hop.
Well, album. I think the Daily Examiner is readable.
Some people
on my timeline think it's terrible. This is. Why do they publish these people who write into the paper? Is it because they're the only people who buy the paper? That's kind of
Yeah, so, and there's a slight chance that he might be on the pod next week, so I was hoping he would be willing to talk about it. But,
I bet it'll make it great if I listen to it and go, this is a bag of fucking shit. We had a deal after Earth Boy's album that we weren't going to review any more of your friend's album. Because let's not go too inside baseball, because I was not terribly complimentary about Earth Boy's album. And let's face it, I was playing for jokes because that's my job. Mm. I went for the jokes. I said it was an album about property values. And I don't think it was well received, and I think that's fair enough from his perspective.
Well, look, unless you're willing to listen to the whole Balls podcast After Dark back catalogue, then you're probably not going to get the jokes, are you?
Basically, I am a T-Rex puppet with a hat on. This entire thing is a joke. I am a joke. I am a comedy character played for your fucking entertainment. I gave you my real opinions. You wouldn't be that interested in them. So that's why we do it this way.
Anyway. I genuinely think this is a classic album.
I'll just sit here having an existential crisis, shall I?
I would argue this is my favorite hip hop album of all time from start to finish. I think there's other songs I like more.
I think that question remains, though, and you might not want to answer it today, and you might not be able to answer it with Brighton out there in the room, but you guys have a relationship. How much of it is because you've got affection for the dude who made it? I mean, friends of mine have made stuff. Like, my brother is an artist. He lives in London. He makes weird, fucked up shit. I don't know what my reaction to it would be if it wasn't my brother. I love it because it's him. I don't know what my reaction would be if it was from just some rando.
I don't like astronomy class as much, though, and that's got him in it. I don't like I don't know.
What's the difference in sound? Too much physics.
I'll leave it to next week about why the difference in sound, because that's part of why I really like this album. There is a specific
But you're not
going
to be able to say that with the dude in the room.
I will. But like, okay.
Shouts
like,
to Battler if he's listening, because he's a good dude.
I know the Funkhaus guys as well. I know the Hilltops guys as well. I know Lazy Gray and
jeez, you've fucking been the Hilltops. Jesus, you've gone after them.
I know Brother Stoney way better than I know Battler, but there's...
Hear that, Battler? I wouldn't take that, man.
There is a specific thing about this album that I think makes it an absolute classic, so...
Cause Battler's a Sydney-sider originally, isn't he? He's not a Brisbaneite. He's not part of that tribe.
He's an Elephant Tracks dude, you know. Yep. I think they still do. They sort of own Sydney.
Well, apart from that little enclave that decided to dob to SBS Viceland.
Yes, that's right. Yes, there is a little bit that Elephant Tracks don't own, but anyway. Well, anyway, I'll be interested to see.
Let's face it, the idea of white Australians owning hip-hop is laughable in any context, is it not?
Well...
we need to check ourselves about that whole, you know, cultural appropriation shit.
There was a funny thing Flynn Hart had today about cultural appropriation where, and I've never really thought about it this way because he's a writer, so it falls into his, you know, like there's this whole thing in, particularly in genre writing at the moment where it's like if you don't have experience of a subculture, you can't write about it. So, you know, you shouldn't be writing an Asian character unless you're Asian. You shouldn't be writing strong women characters unless you're women.
That's really tough. Because if you don't write strong women characters, you look like a fucking douchebag. But if you do write strong women, I think the problem is if you write strong women characters badly, whereby they're just basically dudes with tits, then, yeah, I can see why you should cop some shit for that.
Well, his point was, if you're an Australian cook, if you cook in Australia, you are taking bits from a whole heap of, especially now, if you're a decent cook in Australia, like even someone like me, you're not cooking your, you know, third rate British, you know, sort of cooking. You're pulling out of Vietnamese and Thai. And
is this
French.
Where you claim the greatest Thai chef in the world is an Australian white dude again? Because that went really well last time.
No, that's. Okay, do your research before you make that comment. That guy is, like, in Thailand, he is revered as one of the greatest Thai chefs going around. I'm not bullshitting you, man. He is that is an actual thing. He has been employed by the Thai government to teach Thai restaurants how to cook Thai. That's not a bullshit thing. That's why I asked. Like, if you're upping him as one of the great Thai chefs, he actually is one of the great Thai chefs. He's revered in Thailand as one of the great Thai chefs. He lived in Thailand for most of his life. I don't know whether it's him, though. That's why I asked, because if it's someone else, then, okay, it's surely bullshit. But, like, even Thai people will tell you that David Thompson is one of the great Thai chefs. He just happens to be an Australian dude. I don't know what to say. Like, that's a weird sort of exception that proves the rule thing, but he is actually in the exception that proves the rule. Anyway, I've gone off track a bit. I completely lost my train of thought. You've done it to me the way I did it to you earlier. Yeah, but
if I could remember what it was, I'd help.
No, I guess it's...
Like, fuck, what was he talking about? Save the fucking podcast, you cunt. I've got nothing.
If you can steal a whole heap of stuff from food culture...
Cultural appropriation. That was what we were talking about.
Yeah, cultural appropriation. If you can steal a whole heap of stuff from food culture and that's widely accepted, then...
And I realise that two white dudes talking about cultural appropriation is bullshit.
Yep.
Set it aside. Keep going.
Yeah. Like, this is not me saying that it should be a particular way. It's me not understanding why food is not seen as cultural appropriation, but clothing is. And I really want to know why that is so. Because I've got a couple of friends from other cultures that get really upset with people riffing off like traditional national dress, but have no problems with the multicultural food mix that happens in Australia. In fact, they celebrate it.
Food is something you have to do. Whereas putting a fake, dodgy, fucking Indian headdress on your head is a choice that you've made.
Yeah. So where does, like, I can totally see that.
We are inequipped to fucking have this discussion.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
But let's wade in.
We're about as woke as
Rip Van Winkle. Let's go in.
But the difference is that I'm not Skip Bayless-ing it. I'm not saying you should do it this way.
Because you'd be saying that LeBron isn't clutch. And the Spurs would have won the series.
I can totally understand that, you know, having shots out of a fucking didgeridoo at an Australian bar.
I saw that on Twitter.
is not that cool, or wearing an Indian headdress is not that. Like, I understand that, but if you but where I struggle, and I would like someone to explain this to me, is where if you are a fashion designer and you see a particular style that goes through Asian historical fashion and you want to riff off that, is that building on the shoulders of other people, which happens in lots of cultures, like movie culture, music culture, food culture, like, is that cultural appropriation or is that just
sampling
influences? Sampling, yeah. And that's where I really struggle. What's the difference between that sample culture or that food culture, which is celebrated, and cultural appropriation? And I guess there is a line where it tips over from one into the other.
I think it's because clothing is a different thing. Clothing is a much more... If you look through the history of human civilization, clothing has been used to... has been a primary denoter of cultural touchstones. Whether it's, like, you know, the robes that you'd wear if you're fucking doing an Aztec fucking sacrifice, or what the Pope wears, or, you know, whatever else. That has been... That's alpha fucking signifier. Food is... Because food is such a regular thing. It's such a... You know,
it's probably also very fluid. Like, it's not... You know, it's a lot less static. You know, even food within a culture is changing.
I personally don't think there's a clean answer to this. And I don't, and I'm sure. And do you know what? I think there's a couple of PhD theses in this, to be perfectly honest.
The only reason I brought it up is because Flint Hart is about as woke as a person as I know. Like, that man is that man is pretty much, you know, he's fucking open to just about everything.
The idea that you shouldn't write characters that you aren't becomes super problematic because all you'll end up writing is just white dudes. And yeah. I think that's more destructive.
Well, and then what do you get into is, like, I can't write fantasy because I'm not a fucking dwarf or an elf. I can't write
Game of Thrones because G.R.R. Martin isn't a fucking dragon.
That's right.
Or a midget who cuts people's balls off.
I can't write Star Wars spin-offs because I don't have the Force and I can't not fucking dress fucking up in a big Wookie. Black fucking cape.
It does get ridiculous awfully quickly. I think if you're writing realistic fiction and you, I think what that is a reaction against dudes writing really bad female characters or writing really bad ethnic characters. Like, basically what this all comes down to is that white dudes are fucking trash and should be really should be given no leeway whatsoever, including this podcast. Everything we've said is terrible and you shouldn't listen to it. But that's kind of it, is that by dudes doing a bad job and ruining it, then you end up with responses like that, look, if you don't know what you're talking about, don't fucking talk, which I think is not a ridiculous point to not a ridiculous position to come from. But
except we have 200 episodes of this podcast.
And if you're writing a story where there's a fucking, where there's an Asian female heroine and your best mate in high school was an Asian female who you fucking think is awesome, you can write that character if you've got experience of it.
Yeah.
But I think that's the point. You've got to have you don't have to be, you don't have to be an Asian female to write the experience of an Asian female, but you have to have very fucking good knowledge of what it's like to live that life.
Yeah, well, I just reread over the weekend a book from one of my favorite authors, which is about the 15 years missing of Jesus Christ's life in
on the piss.
You know, if you look at the Gospels, he sort of, you know, he exists up until he's 12 and then he disappears until he's 32.
Yeah, he had a few gap years.
Yeah, so this book is a very fucking humorous book that sort of uses what was happening in the world at that particular time, you know, in terms of India and China and stuff like that, with a whole massive amount of artistic license, but is just absolutely fucking hilarious. And it's written from the viewpoint of Christ's best mate, who's basically like you and takes the piss all the time. And I'm pretty sure that...
Some random alcoholic who lives in a dungeon.
Well, yeah, pretty much. But I'm pretty sure that the author wasn't alive when Christ was around. So, you know, is that cultural appropriation? But I know he did a shitload of research. And
you have to put it in context, yeah. I think comments like that come from a extremist place. Comes from a, you shouldn't write this unless you're from this place. Yeah. Most people would say, you shouldn't write this unless you can write in the voice of this place, which might involve a shitload of research. It might involve personal experience. It might involve being. But we don't have any literature if we don't write about voices we don't have. And to be honest, it's more the most interesting characters I've ever written in my shitty fucking amateur fiction career have been people who I'm not, but people who were really fun to create out of the bits of people I know and out of experiences that I've had and people I've interacted with. They've been the most fun people to kind of write in the voice of, because you can put yourself in their shoes and you can think about very carefully about what motivates that person. Where do they come from? What's their background? What are the things that limit their, you know, what factors stop them from doing the things they want to do? You know, what's their reality like? How is it different to mine as a fucking, as a fucking comfortable white dude? And even as a comfortable white dude, we have fucking, we have world of shit that comes down in our head. Yeah. I mean, comfortable white dude is the easiest difficulty level to play life on, but an awful lot of them seem to off themselves.
Yep.
Like at a furious fucking rate. So it can't be that fucking easy.
Can't be all shits and giggles.
No. even if you're Chris Cornell, which is right, where so we came
on,
in.
On that very friendly note, shall we wrap it up for this week?
Look after yourself, people.
Yep. Catch you on the flip side.